So here we are in 3 weeks, which is a time that we have to think about the Nagu Kavod Zebaze.
3 weeks or the Omer?
The Omer, I meant to say. He just gave a lecture about the 3 weeks. So he'll start again. And our discussion about ethics, I think, is relevant to the Omer period because of Nagu Kavod Zebaze. That's what I wanted to say. This question that I want to touch on tonight borders on, it sort of overlaps two areas. On the one hand, it's business ethics, because you'll see there's $10,000 on the line here in this issue. But it also goes beyond that into other issues of morality and ethics. So I prepared this Mara Makomos page, and I want to just give you the Shaila. The Shaila comes from Mishpatei HaTorah. Remember, I mentioned this Sefer in the past. And he has the following issue. An individual is rushed to the hospital for emergency surgery. The doctors tell him before the surgery that his situation is the following, very severe. If he does nothing, he's got a very short amount of time to live. His days are numbered. The chances of the surgery being successful are also very low. They told him right up front, 90% chance that he will not survive the surgery. But on the 10% chance that it might be successful, it's a better option than not surgery. He asks if he has time before the surgery to meet with his rabbi. And they grant him that. His Rav comes to see him, and in a closed room, in a private discussion, he says to the rabbi, I don't think I'm going to survive this, but I want to do tshuva, especially for two terrible sins that I committed. One is, unbeknown to my partner, I was able to steal from him $10,000. To this day, he doesn't know anything about it. The other terrible sin that I committed is, I lived with a married woman, and he names the woman, before I did tshuva 5 years ago. And he asks the Rav to help him go through the process of tshuva before he enters into the surgery. So if you'll see on the page I gave you, the title of this is Ne'emanus HaChola Al Viduyav Bi'eis Cholya, which means, what is the status halachically, what is the credibility of vidu, a person who confesses crimes at the time of his, what he thinks at least, is going to be his imminent death. In this particular case, chas de shamayim, there were some sort of divine compassion. There was a 10% chance that the surgery would be successful, and indeed it was successful. The man had an amazing recovery. 2 weeks later, he was walking around. And of course, his Rav was very happy. It was a great joy. But his Rav kept on imploring him to return the $10,000 to his pawn. And he kept refusing to do so. Now, word gets back to the partner about his vidu. It's not clear exactly how he found out about it.
It's only one option, though.
Somehow through the rabbi, if that's what you mean.
Yeah.
But I don't know if the rabbi told him directly or in, I don't know exactly. Those details are left out. But be that as it may, this partner demands payment, reimbursement for the embezzlement of $10,000. At that point, the Cholish and Isrape, you know, this fellow who survived the surgery, denies the whole story. The only one who can now testify, obviously, is the Rav. He's the one who heard it. He heard the vidui. Can he support the claim of the partner, and based on that claim, force this individual to pay up to $10,000.
Does the partner have any evidence that it happened? Or is
no evidence whatsoever. It all depends upon whether we accept this vidui.
Now, there may be certain halachic principles that are floating through your mind, but before you mention them, I want to go on to the second issue here, and that is the status of the woman about whom this man confessed had relations outside of the framework of marriage, an adultery relationship, which means that she's not allowed to be married to a husband, which is called in the technical language tumah, and she has to get divorced. What weight does he have, or his vidui, his confession before, again, we call it death, but he survived it, in terms of that marriage relationship?
Sounds like he's going to wish he was dead.
Yeah, that's right. So the first question, I'll read to you the language of the She'ela. Ha'im Rashoi Beit HaDin Al Smach Divrei HaRav. Does the court have the power, the authority, on the basis of the claim, the testimony of the rabbi, L'chayev Et HaMitvadeh, to force the one who recited his vidui, Bal Karcho, against his will, L'shalim L'chutvo Aseres Alofim Dolar? That's question number one. Question number two.
Against his will?
Well, he's not willing to pay. So can the courts force him to pay against
his
will?
Vidui wasn't against
his will. Is he saying he never loaned or never took the $10,000?
Oh, so we're going to get into this. See, there are two possibilities. Either he could say he never recited such a vidui.
Right.
Or he could say, I recited such a vidui, but I never actually stole the $10,000. What I told the rabbi was just a bluff. And the obvious question you can ask yourself is, why would a man bluff on his deathbed? You know, the whole thing is odd. But again, we have to break this down into its component parts. A, what if he denies the whole story, so it's his word against the rabbi's? Because you and I would rather trust the rabbi. But what does the halacha say about it? And secondly, even if I grant you that in a case of his word against the rabbi's, we might want to choose, you know, I want to give more credibility to the rabbi than him. But does the credibility of the rabbi have the power to force this man to pay up? You know, sometimes you could have, for example, one witness who's believed, but that's not exactly enough evidence to force a person to pay.
I have another question.
Just give me one more minute, David. And the second question, what about this married woman? And this misvada, according to his confession, had lived with her, an adultery relationship. Nesral baila. Does she now become prohibited to her husband? And again, what's she saying? Which we're going to get into in a minute. Go ahead, David.
For Catholics, there's a legal protection in many countries of the confidentiality of the confessional.
Right?
In cases of very serious crimes. Within Judaism, there is no such protection. Is that correct?
As far as I know.
So what a congregant tells his rabbi, what a person tells his rav, right, is not necessarily a sacred trust in the sense it's confidential. Is that correct?
I think so. But the issue of confidentiality should be taken up, I think, as a separate issue. What we want to study tonight is what's the status of vidui.
No, I agree. All I'm saying is, if it's a confession, right? Vidui is a confession.
Correct.
Vidui is a confession, right? Is the Rav stepping out of line at all, revealing it? Right? And the answer is no, he's not. This is not a Catholic situation.
Right, right. Jews, I don't see that as a problem.
That's not an issue. Okay, right. I just want to clarify. That's all.
There are other issues that I'm not touching on tonight, which are called Dina de Malchus Dina. In other words, what happens if the law of the land, you know, views this in one light and the Jewish law views it in another light? You know, there's a conflict between the two. As I say, that would require a separate shiur.
Right.
But for tonight, what we want to focus on is assuming that the rabbi comes forward and testifies in the court and has the right to do so.
Right.
What weight do we give to his testimony? What weight do we give to the confession itself? Now, before I read to you his response, you know, the Mishpat HaTorah, his name is Rav Spitz, what I'd like to do is go through some source material with you together, and we begin with a Gemara in Bava Metzia on Daf Gimel Amud Beis. The Gemara records a machlokas between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim. We know that if a man violates what's called an Iser Kares, a severe violation, b'shogeg, unintentionally, then he has to bring what?
Korban.
What's that korban called?
Chatos.
Can we force him to bring a korban chatos? What happens if two witnesses testify against Reuven that we witnessed him eating chalev b'shogeg, and therefore he must bring a korban chatos, and he denies it. The accused denies it. So Rabbi Meir says, chayev, he's got to bring a korban chatos. It's his word against two witnesses. The Torah always trusts two witnesses. And the Chachamim say he doesn't have to bring a chatos. Why doesn't he bring a chatos? So the Gemara uses a strange language. You'll see this on line 3. Ma'im yirtza lomar mezid ha'yisi. He has the ability to say, oh yes, I ate chalev, but it was an intentional violation. For an intentional violation of chalev, does he bring a korban chatos?
No.
So Rashi says, Hayayachal lomar mezid ha'yisi v'yipotem en ha'korban, af kisha amar lo achalti potter. Since if he wanted to circumvent the obligation to bring a korban, he could have done so by claiming he was a mezid. Therefore, believe him when he says that he never ate chalev. What does that smack of? What concept in halacha? Believe me when I say X, because I could have said Y.
Migu.
Sounds like a migu. Now let's ask ourselves the question. Well, indeed, if he would have stepped forward and said, I ate chalev mezid, would he be believed? So all the Rishonim, which I quote here, you'll see the Ramban and the Tosis Rid, they all yell and scream, no, he would not be believed if he testified in court, I ate chalev.
Well, he's not, of course, if he's saying, I'm enjoying eating chalev.
Well, no, let's say he says, I eat chalev, but now I did tshuva. I'm not be chorus. But why isn't a person believed to say, I ate chalev? So here we have another principle, which comes from other Gemaras. Namely what?
Because he's not making himself a Rasha.
Correct. Ein other meisim atzma Rasha. Self-incrimination is not acceptable in Jewish law. So here the Gemara is saying, according to Chacham, he doesn't bring a korban when two witnesses testify that he ate chalev b'shogeg. Why? Because he could have claimed, yeah, I ate the chalev. You, what you saw is correct. But I was amazed that they could never know. So the Rishonim say, what do you mean? He's not believed to say, I ate chalev amazed. That would be in violation of the principle of ein odem meisim atzma. Person is not believed to incriminate himself.
But the idea of bringing a korban, if you're b'shogeg, it's a chesed on the part of Hashem. It's an easy way out. Why would a person, just because of the expense, why would a person not bring it?
Well, again, we have to determine whether he actually ate the chalev. He's claiming he didn't eat the chalev. So what do we do in this case? Do we force him to bring a korban? Rabbeinu says yes. We have two edim. That's objective evidence. That's clear as day that he ate the chalev. He's got to bring a korban. Chacham say no. Let's believe him. So one issue that the Rishonim are going to raise is, well, it's a migu on his part that he didn't eat the chalev against two witnesses. And two witnesses is more powerful, outweighs a migu. That's one issue. Sound of the Chacham say that he's part. Another issue, which is the one we want to focus on, is, so what? Had he confessed to the crime, the mazid, your assumption is he would be believed? Why would he be believed? That's in violation of the principle of Ein Adam Meisim Atzmo Rosh.
Yeah, but then what happens? What about the Edom, though? What are you saying about the Edom?
The status of the Edom henceforth, you mean? Do we believe them?
Mama
said. According to Chachamim?
Right, if he's missing Ein Adam Meisim Atzmo Rosh, so what happens to those two Edom? They just testify they chela for nothing?
Did you call her Sal and her?
Wait a minute, what are you assuming now? You're assuming now
Isaac
that he's believed that he doesn't have to bring a korban like the Chachamim.
Right.
Despite the fact that the Edom testify that he did eat chalev.
Right.
So what do we do with the Edom?
Yeah.
That doesn't bother me, because again, if let's say all things are equal and we don't know who to believe, he's not going to bring a korban.
Correct.
So if his migu squares off with the Edom, we'll call it 50-50, it's even Stephen, then we don't know who's telling the truth, but we certainly can't force him to bring a karmic. Alternatively, as we'll see in Tosus and the Ramban and so forth, maybe as far as carbon is, because it's a very personal issue, so we can believe him, even though objectively maybe we should believe the Edom. So I'm not so worried about the Edom, but I want to know, would he be believed? Does he have nemunus through confession of a crime? And that's going to be relevant to our issue, because if you remember, our cholel on his deathbed, again he survived it, confessed to two different severe crimes. The question is, do we believe him? So if you take a look at the Ramban explains that this issue of bringing a korban is an exception to the rule, because it's a milsa de nafshehi. It's something very personal. And therefore, whether he is chayav a korban or not chayav a korban, that's in a different domain. That's more in a private realm. The Tosus Rit says that even though in general ain other meisim atzmo rasha, but if a person has vested interests to make himself into a rasha, if he gains something monetarily by incriminating himself, then we should believe him. And in this case, by saving himself the hassle of bringing a korban, maybe we should believe him. But what I'd like to focus on is Tosus, which is the fourth source on your page. The imtomar veheich neman lomar mezer ayisi ha'ein other mezer matzmo rasha, and he quotes the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Yesh lomar the eino neman lifsol atzmo aval hacha oset tshuva the eino rotze lahavi chu and lazar. This man is doing tshuva for the crime of eating chalev. If he'll bring the korban knowing that he was amazed, that's called chul lazor. He's not chayav a korban, and he violates a terrible avera if he brings a korban when he's not chayav a korban. That's called chul lazor. So therefore, says Tosus, we have all the reason in the world to believe. So you'll take a look at the next source, is the Gemara Krisus. The Gemara Krisus Daf Yud Beis says that Adam Neman Al Atzmo Yoser Bimea Ish, a person is believed with regard to his own obligations, even against the testimony of 100 witnesses. So if a man comes into court and he says, "I owe Reuven $1,000," he'll have to pay the $1,000, even if the Edom contradict him. Adam Neman Al Atzmo. But to make himself a rush, he's not believed. However, in cases where we really think that he's telling the truth, If there's heavy evidence weighing in for his credibility, then we overlook or override the principle of Ein Adam Meisim Atzmo Rasha. What would be a reason to believe that he's telling the truth? Because he's doing tshuva. If he's doing tshuva, he doesn't want to bring a karbon when he's not obligated to do so. That would be in violation of Chulin Lazara. Let's come full swing back to our case now. In our circumstance, why does he tell the rabbi about his two sins? He's doing what?
He's doing tshuva.
No, if he's doing tshuva, then we have reason to believe that what he says is true. And we don't apply the principle of Ein Adam Meisim Atzmo Rasha. Ein Adam Meisim Atzmo Rasha is not an absolute rule. It's not ironclad. Usually we don't believe a person. But if there's heavy evidence weighing in to believe him, for example, he's doing tshuva, and in the process of tshuva he has to incriminate himself by confessing his crime, then we suspend the normal rule of Ein Adam Meisim Atzmo Rasha, and we believe him. And I'll tell you something else. There's also a sugya in Sanhedrin called Palgina Dibura. A man incriminates himself, but in the incrimination, his testimony is relevant to something else or someone else. We split it in half. We say, insofar as his testimony incriminating himself, we don't believe him, but we will believe him as far as someone else is concerned. For example, if let's say his criminal act generates a monetary obligation to pay monies that he stole or embezzled, then we'll say the following. We don't believe that you embezzled it, but you do admit that you owe the money. So palgina dibur, we'll split it. We won't believe you to apostle yourself, we'll believe you to pay up the money, to be mechayev yourself in dini mamonos. Here, he says he stole from his partner, he confesses on his deathbed, we'll call it, $10,000. So let's believe him as far as the chiyuv mamon is concerned, to pay up the $1,000. We might not believe that he stole it, because that would be ain't other meisim atzmo rasha. And kal v'chomer we should believe him, how much more so when he's doing tshuva? Because now the principle of Ein Adam Meisim Atzmo Rasha doesn't kick in at all.
And the part with the woman?
Okay, we're going to come to the woman in a minute. So let me read to you the comment of the Shach in Choshen Mishpat, which you'll see here on the page. The Shulchan Aruch says that a person on his deathbed, that's called a Shchiv Meira, who makes a claim, or I should say admits to a claim, that he owes money, later on, if he comes forward and says, I was not serious about it, it was a joke, we don't believe him. A man on his deathbed is very serious. He doesn't make jokes. And that's based on a Gemara Bava Basra, which you'll see here on the page. Ein Adam Meshateh B'Shas Misa. A person doesn't say things that are cynical or lightheaded on his deathbed. However, the Shach disagrees. The Shach in Choshei Mishpat Simen Pei Aleph says Lefi Ani Inestaiti Ze Eino. And even if he confessed that he owes money at the time of his death, later on he could say Meshata, you see I wasn't serious, and he could deny it. However, all the posts can reject the Shach. The Nesivis and the Ketzos and the Tumim, one after the other, they all subscribe to the position of Rav Yosef Karo, that when a person says he owes money on his deathbed, he cannot later on deny it and say, oh, I was just joking around. Meshata Isiba. In fact, the Mishnah says, and that you'll see here, the third source before the end of your page in Gittin, that if the Kohanim were doing the Avodah and bringing a carbon on behalf of someone, and they said, we accidentally had the wrong machshava, the wrong thoughts, and that's called pigul, and therefore the whole carbon is null and void, which is a tremendous financial loss to the Baal HaKarbon, but he's going to have to replace it. So the Mishnah says, if you'll see it, Mizidim Chayovim. If they claim that they did it deliberately, they'll have to pay for the carbon like a mazik. If they say they were shogeg, they did it inadvertently, then although the carbon is completely invalidated, they don't have to pay because they did it b'shogeg. But how do we know that they were mefagel? We only know it from their own admission. But I know the Mesim Atzmo Rosh, a person can't incriminate himself. So once again, you see that there's an exception to the rule. If this man is saying, the Kohen, that I was mefagel, which implies that I have to pay to replace the carbon because I caused its deficit, why would a person lie under those situations and incur such a major obligation, financial obligation? So whenever we have reason to believe, the evidence weighs in that he's telling the truth, despite the fact that he's incriminating himself, he's believed. So if a person is part of the process of tshuva on his deathbed, he confesses to a crime, he says, I embezzled $10,000 from my partner, we're not going to apply the principle of Eino Demeis Matzor Rosh. We're going to assume that he is telling the truth. Now, based on all these sources, and I'll read to you the conclusion of the Mishpatei Torah, he says the following. Im ha-chole she-hivri modeh, if he confesses, shachem b'yeis cholyo hisvada b'fnei rabo, he doesn't deny the confession itself. He says, yeah, I said it to the rabbi. True, the rabbi's not lying. Ela los kavanti b'ritzinus, I didn't mean it seriously. Hareyu chayov l'shalem l'shutfo es meloa aschum anal. He will be penalized, or I shouldn't say penalized, but he will be obligated to pay up the entire sum of $10,000. And if he's not willing to pay, then Beit Din will force him to pay. Why? Because he doesn't deny that he made the confession. He claims rather that the confession was not serious. He didn't mean it. It was a joke. We don't take this as a joke. We take it very seriously. It means he embezzled. He's incriminating himself. Eino Demeisim Atzmo Rosha. The answer is that Eino Demeisim Atzmo Rosha is not an absolute rule. If we have reason to believe that he was serious, that he was honest, then we don't apply the principle of Eino Demeisim Atzmo Rosha. There is nemonas, even to incriminate yourself, if we believe you're telling the truth. However, says the Mishpatei Torah, what if he denies that he ever made the confession? Im achole machrish es divrei rabo, it's his word against the rabbi, v'toein, and he claims, shemi olam lo amar l'rabo dover zeh, he never confessed to such a crime, then Rashaya Shutaf L'Tovo Mibeitin Al Smach Eduta Rav, the partner has rights to claim the $10,000 based on the testimony of the rabbi, but it's only one witness, it's only the rabbi, the partner has no evidence or no knowledge. So what's the story when one witness says that Reuven owes Shimon $10,000? What does Reuven have to do when he denies the claim? Don't answer it at once. Takes an oath. One witness is believed in a Jewish court of law to be mechayev shvuah, to generate an obligation to swear. You, the defendant, have to take an oath to contradict the testimony of one witness. If you refuse to take the oath, you have to pay. You have two choices. Either take the oath or pay. Therefore, in this case, that the rabbi has the evidence, the weight of one aid, of one witness, in Yiru Bezdin Shanitva Minaselit Chamek Milushava, we see that this guy is trying to wiggle his way out of it. He doesn't want to take the oath, and none of his excuses really convince Beit Din. You know, he says, "Oh, I don't want to take an oath. You know, it's too heavy. It's too you know." All of a sudden, he became such a saint. Hey, Mechayvim L'shalem's Kosel. They could force him to pay. He refused to take the oath. However, if it seems to Beit Din that he, the defendant in this case, right, the chola that is willing to take the oath. However, our courts are not too enthused about imposing an oath. Then he says, Beit Din should work out a compromise. He says the following: in Yira LeBeit Din, Shanitpa Muchan Lishava, he's willing to take the oath. Rashai Beit Din Rimanami Lashbio, they can deny, they can withhold the oath and make a compromise.
Compromise worse than compromise?
So that I don't know. That's not clear to me from the truth. But it seems from his language, Lachufo Litpasher, that they do have the power to force him to compromise. Now, I'm not sure if he would have had to sign a compromise agreement up front, or just simply based on the testimony of one witness against him, that's enough to force a compromise.
What's a compromise?
Compromise would be $5,000.
But he's saying nothing.
Doesn't matter. He's obligated to take an oath, and we cannot impose the oath. So you have to sort of redeem the oath. How do you redeem the oath? You pay half the price. Again, it's only because there's such heavy evidence against
him. This is with the assumption that the witness is an impeccable witness, which it seems
correct.
To be.
Correct.
With nothing to gain.
Correct.
In this case.
Correct. Now, let's finish up. I know it's getting late. What time is it now?
Can I ask one question?
Yeah.
Sure. It seems to me that if the person is already denying a fact,
right?
He's not a God-fearing person. So when he's asked to take an oath, it should be relatively easy for him to take the oath. You know, I mean, if this is true, if he did make the confession, and now he's saying my Rav is a liar,
right?
Why does he have any problem taking the oath? He's obviously not a God-fearing man.
It's interesting.
And maybe that's why the Beit Din doesn't want to impose it on him.
The halacha operates with for this we'd have to learn a lot about Mitzvah, but the halacha operates with the following premise. A person could be a no good thief, he embezzles money, he doesn't care about Lo Signov, but he won't take a false oath.
Because the punishment is karet?
I wouldn't say it's karet, but it's close to it. Again, we can discuss this at great length, but about the violation of Shvua Sheker, the Torah says, Lo Yenakeh. His children will be punished. It's his generations. It's a whole thing. The Gemara says when the Torah said, Lo Tisa Shem Hashem L'Shavah, you can't take an oath in vain with God's name, the world, the universe shook. Abrameos Pars, Al Abrameos Pars. The severity of the oath is beyond comprehension. And it penetrated into the human, I should say the Jewish consciousness, way beyond the Easter of Gzeil. It's mind-boggling. You know,
what is bearing false witness? Like when he denies
witness,
it
is the real false story. Witness is also very severe. But in a sense, Shvua Sheker is even more severe.
More severe. Okay.
Because he takes the name of God.
Right.
It's an absolute desecration of the name of God. Okay. And the worst thieves were afraid of a Shvua. That's called in the Gemara's language, Chashad Amamona, Lo Chashad Ashvos. What about the woman? So here I want to call your attention to a Mishnah in the Dharam, which is the last source on your page. And the Mishnah says that Barishona, originally, there were two historical periods, Hayu Omrim, the halacha was, that there are three women who have to get divorced from their husbands, one of which is a woman who says, Homeres, Tmeani lecha. I had relations, extramarital relations. She can no longer live with her husband. We'll force them to give a divorce. Bachrona, later on in Jewish history, Chazal had a reversal. And they said she's not believed. Why? Shema nosna einel bach. Maybe, perhaps, she wants to get out of this marriage. She has her eye on somebody else. She didn't actually have adultery with him. She's lying. But she figures, you know what? I got a joker card here. I have an easy way of forcing his hand, my husband's hand, to divorce me. I'm going to say I had relations with another man. She's not believed. Now, the conclusion of all this might be that if in our case we were to subpoena the woman to court, even if she were to admit to the crime, the so-called accusation, we would still not break up this marriage. Why? Because we paskin la'halacha like the Mishnah Achrona. The final word is that a woman's not believed to say she had extramarital relations. So therefore, the Mishpat Torah says something that we have to analyze. He says, "B'yachas levidu yachol lefnei rav shechai chayishus be'isur meishes ish," and the chol himself admits that he did recite that vidu, he did confess to that crime. Ha'isha gam kein moda, she also admits that she had this relationship. Now, we put together her admission together with his claim, which he made on the vidui, and he's not denying it. He says, Chayav habal legarish ishto. We will force the husband to divorce his wife. Afilu im baila eino mamin lidvarel. Even though the husband doesn't believe her, nevertheless, he has to divorce his wife. And the reason for this is because the Mishnah Rishona was not totally rejected. The Mishnah Rishona says that if we don't have any evidence other than the fact that she admits to the crime, we don't believe her. She may have vested interests. However, if there is external evidence that supports our conclusion that she's telling the truth, then the poskim say, we go back to the Mishnah Rishona. The Mishnah Rishona was not totally rejected, as I said before. We don't usually believe her. We think she's lying. That's the Mishnah Rishona. But the Mishnah Rishona believes her. We will fall back on the Mishnah Rishona and embrace that halacha if we have evidence, circumstances that indicate, or some testimony that indicates that she's telling the truth. What evidence do we have?
The other confession.
Correct. Maybe he's lying too?
Yeah, it could be in cahoots.
He's the same guy who was lying
but
earlier.
The answer is, when did he make this confession?
We thought he had nothing to lose.
When he thought, and this is clear, this is not questionable, that he was about to die. What a person says on his deathbed gives credence, gives some extra weight of evidence to his confession. That evidence is enough to shift from the Mishnah Achrona back to the Mishnah Rishon. However, what happens if she denies the claim? He says the following: Aval ma'isha makchishas divrei acholin. Even though there's a lot of evidence that this man on his deathbed was telling the truth, we will not bust up this marriage. Why? Because his word alone is not sufficient, even with all the weight of the evidence. And here we employ the principle of Ein Dover Shebe'er V'Pachas Mishnah. We need two witnesses to testify against a woman on such a severe crime with such heavy repercussions as to break up the marriage. If we only have one witness, no matter how believable that witness is, that's not enough. And she still remains Muteris Levi. So let's just summarize. If she admits that she had this relationship. Then, together with his evidence, the evidence of his confession, which is very weighty, we go back to the Mishnah Rishon. If, on the other hand, she denies it, and that all we have now is his testimony on his deathbed, which is very weighty, but it is, it only adds up to one witness, we cannot break up this marriage. In fact, he goes a step further. Adif shalol esaper lebayit. That's all discussion unto itself. He says, better not to even tell the husband about it. Let the marriage continue.
What if she admits and the person who's on his deathbed recants, but the Rav says, but I heard you say
yeah, this is a real situation.
Can Rav be the second witness?
Correct.
Oh yeah?
Yeah.
So then it doesn't matter if the person recants or not.
As long as you have the testimony of the rabbi that he made that confession. So but given the fact that
this is the not directly from the horse's mouth, it's one person removed.
But again, if we believe the rabbi, and that goes back to our first issue, which we said at least we believe the rabbi enough to force a shvuah, an oath, and that has tremendous weight because if he doesn't take the oath, he has to pay $10,000, but it could have been $1 million. So you see that the testimony of the rabbi as an independent source of evidence is very weighty. That should be enough to bring us back to the Mishnah Rishonah. The Mishnah Rishonah says that if a woman admits to the crime, then we break up the marriage. We suspended the Mishnah Rishonah because we said that's not enough evidence. We really think she's lying. She might be lying. She has vested interests here. She's making up the whole story. But if we realize from independent evidence that indicates that she's not making up the story, this is not something that, you know, that she invented for her convenience sake to achieve her goal of getting a get and getting out of this marriage, so there's an independent source of evidence, then we go back to the Mishnah.
So I just want to get clear.
It's fascinating, no? I mean,
if the man on his deathbed says, I was just joking with my Rav, we assume that that's not true, right? And he has to pay the full $10,000, and in fact we accept that evidence in terms of the divorce as well. If he says, I never said it and the Rav is making it up, then he has to swear an oath or make a compromise at that point. In which case, we're believing the Rav at that point to a very large degree, but we can't force the issue.
But again, not because he's a Rav, but as an Eidech.
As a good witness. So because he's a good witness, he's corroboration for her saying, the Rav is, not the person on deathbed. The Rav is corroborating her statement, yes, I did commit this act. And then we break up the marriage.
Right. Okay. One last thing and I'll let you go. He says, what if a woman on her quote-unquote deathbed, but that's what she thinks, confesses to having an extramarital relationship, and then she survives this choli and she's healthy, and now she continues to admit and confess the crime that she had confessed on her deathbed. She wants to do tshuva. She would like to remain married to her husband. What do you do in that case? All we have is her testimony and nothing else. We have no external evidence. There's no Rav, there's no Boel, you know, the one who had the relations with her, who admitted it. There's no Eid Echad. So I thought this would be an open and shut case. This is the Mishnah Achrona against the Mishnah Rishona. He says the following: Im viduya haikisha haisa chola b'machla shalo haisa ba sakonis chayim. If she recited that vidu when her life was not threatened, or it's not a hopeless situation, a very dangerous one, very dangerous illness, but there was a sikui savir, I don't know how to translate that, there's a probability, a reasonable probability, shetavri, then we don't believe her. And even though she's telling us that she's confessing because she wants to do tshuva, it's still one admission, one confession of hers, and her husband can remain married. However, im matzava refui shel aisha beit viduyeha hayadona lenidon b'sheva she'ilo. If, however, the circumstances surrounding her confession at the time of her illness were parallel, were similar to the one that we described in our case, the physicians told her, forget it, your body will not survive this disease. Even if we operate, even with the surgery that we recommend, there's a 10% chance that you'll survive it. Then, in his vadisa, if she recited this vidu and confessed to this crime after the physicians told her that her days are numbered, that she has very, if minute, if any chance of surviving, and then yom li achra vidui higia lebeit cholim rofei, miracle of miracles, the day after her confession, who shows up in the hospital? A physician. He's got a new method of surgery. A new, what word am I looking for?
New procedure.
The mikra zeh nemenes bidvareh. We believe what she said at the time of her confession. He neseres al baila v'chayav habaila l'gash. We go back to the Mishnah Rishon that says we trust our confession. Because even though there's no independent source of evidence to support our confession, but nevertheless the context of our confession itself.
Yeah, she can't be using the confession to get out of her marriage if she's dying.
Exactly.
It doesn't make sense. That's
good. Okay, my friends.
Thank you.
Well, we'll stop here. I mean, I thought this was a fascinating discussion.